So tonight we're looking at Psalm 8. It's kind of a different kind of psalm to many of the other ones that you'll read in its structure and those sorts of things. But the Psalm 8 tonight is a psalm particularly about what it is to be a human being. And this is God's view on what it is to be a human being, which we can learn from. But in our culture, we have different ideas about what we think it is to be human. Or there are certain questions or statements that we would ask of ourselves, what does it mean to be a human being? So here's some ideas I'll throw at you about what it is to be human that I think our culture sort of puts forward. So one thing it would say, to be human is to have free choice. So to do whatever you want. That's what humans can do. Another thing that people would say is to be human is to express yourself however you want. We call this just being yourself and let no one tell you otherwise. That's what it kind of means to be human, just be you. Some people say that to be human is to have rights. We love our human rights. We are an entitled bunch of people. And so to be human is to have certain rights and how we express those. To be human is to have dignity and respect. I like that. That's a good way of thinking about it. To be human is to belong. And that's part of what makes us up to be human. So it's a big question. What is it? What is a human being and what is it to be human? It's a question that our society and our culture is asking of itself all the time. It wants answers for, and we're constantly looking for them. And just in the few examples I gave you of way people think about being a human, you can probably think of more, shows that we're asking this question. It's a big deal. And our passage tonight deals with this, but it deals with it in such a way that it takes into account two things that are very difficult to understand. That blow our mind, that sometimes even so big that we don't always experience them. And the two things that it deals with here are the universe and human beings. That's the things that we see in our psalm. And a lot of people in our culture try and tie these two things together or figure out how they work because they are difficult to understand. And so Albert Einstein is one guy that you may have heard of, a scientist, and he tried to figure this out, and he said two things are infinite. One is the universe, and the second one is human stupidity. He said, I'm not sure about the universe. I'll leave that with you for a sec. Carl Sagan, another guy, he said, the beauty of the living thing is not the atoms that go into it, but the way those atoms are put together. So it's not the atoms themselves, but the way they're put together. There's a guy by the name of Lawrence Krauss, you may have heard him. He's a theoretical physicist, really smart guy. And he wrote a book called A Universe from Nothing. And he said this in his book, trying to help us understand these two big concepts. He says, the amazing thing is that every atom in your body came from a star that exploded. And the atoms in your left hand probably come from a different star than your right hand. It really is, two galaxies, it really is the most poetic thing I know about physics. You are all stardust. Yeah, it's romantic, isn't it? You couldn't be here if stars hadn't exploded because the elements, that is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, all the things that matter for evolution, weren't created at the beginning of time. They were created in the nuclear furnaces of stars. And the only way they could get into your body is if those stars were kind enough to explode. You are the result of a kind exploding star. He goes on to say, so forget Jesus. The stars died so that you could be here today. Interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. Ellen DeGeneres, she pipes in a bit and she says, the only thing that scares me more than space aliens is the idea that there aren't any space aliens. We can't be the best that creation has to offer. I pray we're not all there is. If so, we're in big trouble. Isn't that one of the saddest things you've ever heard? I'm not even sure who she prays to. And Stephen Hawking, who passed away earlier this year, end of last year, said this, remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Good advice, isn't it? Because we see that in Psalm 8. And then he says, be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up. So these are some of the ways that people in our culture are thinking about these ideas of the universe and what it is to be a human, and even how they fit together. And the great thing about that is Psalm 8 addresses it. It addresses both of these things and helps us to know what's going on. So I've called tonight to be known. And the way I want to attack this is, firstly, I want us to see, to think about who do you see. The second thing I want you to think about is who sees you, and how do we know that we've been seen? And I'm using the word see because that's what David's doing in this psalm. He's talking about things that he sees. In verse 3, he talks about he considers the work of that God has done with his fingers. So David is seeing things and he's thinking through things, and that's why I'm trying to use that language. And these are the way I want us to think about this psalm tonight. So firstly, who do you see? Because in the psalm, Psalm 8, firstly we're seeing what David sees. So if you look with me at chapter 8, verse 1, second half of the verse, "You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger." That's not Captain America and his team, by the way. Verse 3, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, and the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them?" So what's happening here first is we see what David is seeing. He talks about the fact that God has set his glory in the heavens. So here's David out in the field looking after sheep, lying down and seeing this incredible array of light right above him. He can't touch it, he can't smell it, he can't, may not even be able to hear it, but he can see the amazing array of lights in front of him. And he says that God has set this as his glory in front of him. And then he goes on in verse 2, "Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger." So what he's saying here in verse 2 is that God is so big that the most vulnerable sing God's praises, and that deals with his enemies. That's incredible. Who are God's enemies? Well, in Psalm 2, we're told who God's enemies are. They're the nations that conspire against God. They're the kings of the earth that try and say, let's get rid of God. Let's throw off our shackles and just be whoever we want. That's who God's enemies are. The people in our world with the most power can't even stand up against the Creator, who builds a stronghold in the praises of the most vulnerable of his creation. That's a big God. The people that we think have the power can't even overcome God and the praises of children and infants. That's how big he is. So it makes us look pretty silly when we get angry with God and sort of say he's not there, doesn't it? When we try and conspire against him, it makes us look foolish. And that's what God is doing. He's that big. We're told that he sets his glory in the heavens. When he's saying that, the idea that's behind the language there is that he places or sets things. He puts them there deliberately. And then in verse 3, when he says that you have set things in place, what he's talking about there is he's put them where he wants them, and he daily regulates their course. I'll decide where they go and what they do. God is deliberate about his creation. And it's massive. To the point where we can't even comprehend it. It is huge. If you look at this next slide, this is in Outback Australia, and if you go out there, away from the light pollution that we have in the city, you can see an incredible array of stars, so much so that even a photograph can't capture it. It is magnificent, and if you haven't done it, then do it. Okay? It is just incredible what you can see. And what you can see there is the Milky Way galaxy. That's the galaxy that we live within. Now, it's hard to get a photo from the outside of the Milky Way galaxy because we live in it. Right? Now, telescope kind of just sits off Earth as a satellite. It's like me asking you to take a photo of the outside of the church from in here. You can't do it. But scientists and those cosmologists and whatever have put some things together, and if you were to work your way out from our galaxy, it would probably look like this. And so you'd look back at it, it would look like a plate with a light in the middle. That's kind of what our galaxy looks like. And so mathematicians and all these kinds of people have put things together, and they put together what our galaxy would look like if you looked down on it, which is the next slide. And we live in a galaxy that is called a spiral galaxy. So where that little arrow is with the sun, that's your house. That's where you live in the Milky Way galaxy. You're not even in the center. We're outside of it. And that's where we live. Now, I looked up the NASA site and got some statistics. Now, if you... So there's a spacecraft called the Voyager, right, which they sent out. And the Voyager moves at a rate of 17.3 kilometers per second. Okay, so that's pretty quick. Now, if you got in the Voyager and went from our sun to the center of our galaxy, it would take more than 450 million years to get there. But if you could travel at the speed of light, which the scientists say you can't do because of a thing called special relativity, oh, I think I've done that wrong. It would take a lot longer. It would take 26,000 years to arrive. That's just from the sun to the center. If you wanted to go from one side of our galaxy to the other, and you wanted to travel at the speed of light, it would take nearly 100,000 years. And that's our galaxy. And there are hundreds and thousands of galaxies in the known universe. It's a pretty good chance we're not going to get to see all of it. God spoke and created that. That is huge. That's the God that David sees behind the stars that he's looking at in the sky. It is massive. If you look at this next slide, if our galaxy was the size of Australia, our solar system, right, that is from the sun to Pluto. Now, I know some people think Pluto's not a planet, but I'm saying it is. Because when I was in school, we learned a rhyme. My very energetic mother just sat upon nine pillows, so we could remember. That might be the only thing you remember tonight. But because I can remember that, I'm including Pluto. If that was the size of our galaxy, then our solar system would be the size of a coffee cup. That's how big our galaxy is. That is how big our Creator God is. And we can look at that and we can be amazed, and throughout history humans have looked at it and even worshipped that stuff. But David's saying there is someone behind it. It's not just what you look at, it's who do you see when you do? Who made it? See, in verse 1, David says, your name is majestic. Verse second half, you set your glory. You have established a stronghold. Verse 3, when I consider your heavens and the works of your fingers. It's not just when I think about the heavens, they're your heavens. The moon and the stars, which you have set in place. Verse 4, you are mindful of them. Verse 5 and 6, you made them. See, everything that David sees, even in the questions that he asks, there is someone behind them. And he says, do you know? Who do you see behind what you're looking at? Because there is someone there. We're always thinking about what's behind something. Who made this or who made that? We do that kind of thing. You know, someone might say to you, oh, do you have a car? And you'll say, oh, I have a car. And now what's the next question? What kind of car is it? Who made your car? You see, we can look at things, but we want to know who's behind them. In verse 3, David says, when I consider your heavens the work of your fingers, we get this beautiful picture of someone who creates with their fingers, and that's another example of God's power. But a guy by the name of Jonathan Edwards, who was a theologian who lived in America in the 18th century, when he thought about this passage, he said, God is not just creating these things scientifically, but he's actually an artist because he creates them with his fingers. And the thing about an artist is you don't just get to see what they do, you learn something about them. You get a look into their heart. What a beautiful picture that is of how great our God is. We often will look at any kind of piece of art, whether it's music or artwork or whatever, and you can see something about the artist in it. Maybe you even know who the artist is. If you hear a song about broken up relationships, it's probably Taylor Swift. You know who's behind it, right? Or you might have your favourite artist and you'll hear a song and you'll say, I know who wrote that song and I love it. I was reading an article this week by an Australian artist by the name of Melissa Lupke. And this lady, for a long time, was a graphic designer. And her and her husband decided that they wanted to have a change in life. And so they bought a farm in northern Tasmania where they were going to live and raise their family and this kind of stuff. And they'd moved in, and their husband was going to church one day on his motorbike, and he came off his motorbike into an oncoming car and ended up in hospital. And they couldn't save him. And so she lost her husband. And things changed for her, and she turned to her artwork to try and learn to express herself, to express her hope and her grief and her sadness. And you can see this in her artwork. And she even includes things in her artwork that were important to her husband and her and to her children, so that we could get a look into her heart. And she wants to take her artwork around so that people can look at it and talk with her and learn how to deal with grief and the hope that she has. But you can see that. You can get a look into her heart through her artwork. We get a look at God through his artistry. We can see here that God shows his power in these stars. We can see his wisdom. He places things the way he wants them and the way that they work best. We get to see his love, because he doesn't create because he needs love. He creates because he's got so much love to give. We get to see that God has an eye for beauty. And all of these things show us what God is like. And David sees that as he writes his psalm. And he talks specifically then about a part of creation. He says, you are so big, that he gets to verse 4 and he says, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you would care for them. We see what the universe is like. So how does God view human beings? This is the second thing I want us to see. Who sees you? What is a human that you are mindful of them? This huge God, how can he even see that I'm here? If the universe is that big and I'm this small person on this small planet, how can he even see me? Well, then he goes on to tell us how that's possible. He says, you have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You have made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. See, there's a couple of things here we see that show who sees us, that this great God can see us. The first one is that he made us. What is human beings that you would be mindful of them? You are in the mind of the Creator, the same one that created the stars and the universe. In fact, in Psalm 139, we are told that he actually knit you together in your mother's womb. He knew you before your mum. This is how he knows you. That's how David can answer his question, the fact that God made us. And because he made you, you matter. He sees you. He sees what he makes. But we're also told there that why would you even care for them? You know, if we have a universe without a God, then who cares for you? Your star's already exploded, according to Lawrence Krauss. Who will care for you? But we're told here that God cares. In fact, the kind of language, the idea it's putting across is that God visits you, walks with you. Creator of that universe walks with you. He made you and he cares for you. That's why he's mindful of you. But lastly, did you see there that he crowns humans with glory and honor? What does it mean that we are crowned with glory and honor? You've got to understand that glory and honor are attributes of God himself. Did you see that in verse 1? You have set your glory in the heavens. God is glorious, yet he crowns us with glory and honor. These are attributes of God himself. We are made in his image. That's why he sees you. And we know that he's crowned us with glory and honor because he's made us rulers over the works of his hands. We are asked to rule over what God has made. Look with me at verse 5. You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. All flocks and herds and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky, the fish of the sea, and all that swim the paths of the sea. You are crowned with glory and honor. It's not an issue that we're made a little lower than the angels, but we're made above everything else to rule it. But when it talks about rule, it doesn't mean you dominate it so we can satisfy our own desires and greed. It's that we care for it. And God has crowned us with glory and honor to do that, to look after the works of his hands. What a privilege. that God would do that, allow us to do that. And as people, there are times when we've done well at this, when we have looked after God's creation, the work of his hands, so that people might flourish. Some people have found cures for diseases. That's an amazing thing. Recently, I did a funeral for a guy who had turned 93 years old. And as I was reflecting on his funeral, I was thinking through all the things that he would have seen in his lifetime. And during his lifetime, he would have seen communication change from calling someone through a telephone exchange to seeing each other via video on the other side of the world in real time. He would have seen that change. But that's a good change that we can do that. These are good things. We have witnessed people, or he would have witnessed people, leaving our planet and landing on another one. We build bridges. We're working hard on finding new ways to harness and produce energy, although we could probably be doing better there. See, there are many ways that God has used us to flourish in the way that we farm and produce food. See, humans are worth something because God made us in his own image. See, it doesn't matter whether you have a disability. It doesn't matter whether you have a mental illness. You're still made by God. That doesn't change. It doesn't matter whether you have two PhDs, whether you're a stay-at-home dad or a mum who's the CEO of a multinational company. It doesn't matter whether you are married, whether you are single. None of these things determine your worth before God. None of them. He is mindful of us and he cares for us because we are known by him. None of these things, whether the differences in us make us more or less worthy of God's love and his care. One guy said this. He said, "The lofty station of humanity described in verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 8 depends on God knowing us in the first place." Who sees you? God sees you, the creator of the universe. That's incredible. But if we believe this about God, then why do we spend so much time trying to change ourselves? Why do we do that? Why do we think that we cannot worship God properly the way we are? You are worth something. It seems to me that we spend a lot of time and energy trying to get the right people to see us. And the creator of the universe sees you. And as Christians, we should see each other. Because we are valued by God, we can value others, we can love others, we can show others grace. But we spend so much time and energy trying to get the right people to see us, whether that's the amount of makeup we wear, the clothes that we wear, the gym that we attend, the things that we do to our bodies that were so graciously given to us by God. You already matter. You already matter. And it's because God sees you. The third thing I want us to see from this passage is, how do we know that we are seen? And I'm asking this question because I see a disconnect in what Psalm 8 is telling us and what our experience is. Psalm 8 looks good. And it looks like we're able to do good things and look after God's planet and each other. But for me, and I'm imagining it's the same for you, that in your experience there's kind of a disconnect between that and between Psalm 8 and your own experience. See, the last week, Pat took us through Psalm 3, and we were thinking about lament psalms. And I think Psalm 8 is a nice ending to those lament psalms. There's five of them. Because in those psalms, we read things like Psalm 3, God will not deliver him. Psalm 4, give relief to my distress. Psalm 4, how long will you love delusions and seek false gods? Psalm 5, consider my lament. Psalm 5, hear my cry for help. Psalm 6, have mercy on me, for I am faint. Psalm 6, my soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord? How long? Psalm 6, I am worn out from my groaning. Psalm 6, All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow wet with sorrow. They fail because of my foes. Psalm 7, save and deliver me from all who pursue me, or they will tear me apart like a lion and rip me to pieces with no one to rescue me. Actually, I've just noticed as the Psalms go on, it gets worse. Life is just hard. That doesn't sound like Psalm 8 to me, where God can see me. All I'm doing is crying for help. My bed is wet with tears. I've got lions ripping me apart. This is where the disconnect comes. And then in Psalm 8 we read, O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. What a contrast. See, there's this disconnect in our personal experiences. Sometimes life is just hard. And we scream, where are you, God? What are you doing? That doesn't sound like Psalm 8. Last week, Pat said that we feel like we don't even have permission to bring our doubt and worry and grief to God. That's true. We do feel that way sometimes. But friends, you are already in the thoughts and care of the Creator. He's not there just to answer what you think you need. He's there to answer what you do need. You see, even when it feels like He's not there, He is. You know, sometimes as a Christian, we don't feel God. Life is not so exciting or fun. It's just mundane. Sometimes your Christian life can feel that way. Maybe the worship tonight is not all that you'd hoped for and you won't walk away buzzing, or the sermon doesn't stimulate you like it did last week. There are times when we don't feel excited about God. Certainly not the way Psalm 8 puts it. Maybe you would rather be somewhere else that seems more exciting and we can get the buzz that you're looking for. And if you base your belief on God that way, it's time to grow up. But not only do we have this disconnect with our personal experience, we have a disconnect with the way that we rule over God's world, over the work of His hands. Because what we do is we ignore the Creator and leave Him out of it, and we try to crown ourselves with glory and honour. And how has that worked out? If you look at this next slide, this is from the United Nations website. 68.5 million people have been forcibly displaced from their homes in our world. That's how well we're looking after each other. 40 million of those are displaced within their countries. 25 million are refugees. 3.1 million asylum seekers. That's how we're looking after each other. If you look at this next slide, that was taken this year in February on a beach in Bali, because my wife and I were thinking about where we'd like to go for a holiday, and we thought Bali's affordable, so we might do that. And we saw this photo, and that rubbish came from Jakarta in Indonesia and went across the ocean and landed on the beaches of Bali. Hundreds and hundreds of tons of plastic. Display of our greed, isn't it? Psalm 8 doesn't necessarily fit the way we think. We have issues with racism, and this psalm says that racism is not on. Even the way we treat each other, we traffic people, we buy and sell people for our own gain and our own greed. What is man? I'm human beings, that you would be mindful of them, that you would care for them. I think here we get to see that actually maybe God's not the issue. Maybe it's us. The disconnect is with us. I know a lot of you like social justice kinds of things. And that's a good thing. I'm all for social justice. My question is why? And I wonder whether we're not more into social justice because that actually makes us feel happy. It doesn't matter what it means for the other person, but it makes me feel happy. But what if we cared because other people carry God's image because he cares for them? What if we did social justice that way? God is described in this psalm as creating the heavens with his fingers. He didn't need help. He didn't seek advice. He was not confined by any material. He created something from nothing. But not only did God create things, but he set the parameters for what would be created. This is how I'll create. This is what I'm going to create. This is the way it works. This is the way I've designed it to work best. And we, as rebellious human beings, try to move outside those parameters to make things the way we want them to be and reject what is best for us within God's design. We take Psalm 8 and we remove God from it. That's why there's a disconnect. Why don't we see this problem? Because we like to leave God out. You know, in the Psalms, you'll often see parallelisms and two lines saying the same thing, and that's to get a point across. And here, it's not really a parallelism in this thing, but it's a similar type of thing, where at the beginning and the end, David is reminding us of who is actually most important in all of this, because he says, "Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." And he finishes with exactly the same line. There's a reason for that. Because God needs to be included, and we've excluded him. So what does God do about it? If you've got your Bibles, can I ask you to turn to Hebrews 2 with me? It's towards the back. Go past Timothy, Titus, Philemon. Hebrews chapter 2, if you're using your Bible. If not, just listen. And I'm reading from verse 6. But there is a place where someone has testified, "What is mankind that you are mindful of them? A son of man that you care for him? You made them a little lower than the angels. You crowned them with glory and honor and put everything under their feet." There's Psalm 8 in Hebrews 2. He then goes to say, "In putting everything under them, God left nothing that is not subject to them. Yet at present, we do not see everything subject to them." You see, the experience of the writer to the Hebrews is the same as ours. We do not see everything subject to them. It's a mess. So what will God do? Hebrews 2:9. "But we do see Jesus, who was made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honor," Psalm 8 language, "because he suffered death so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. And in bringing many sons and daughters to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom through all everything exists, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through what he suffered." We see Jesus, who in his suffering, that means that God put everything under his feet. Jesus became the Psalm 8 person. There's now not a disconnect, there's now a connect because of Jesus Christ. You see, God in Jesus gave up his majestic place to reconcile us back to be the same, to be the Psalm 8 person. This majestic God in the form of Jesus became a man, gave up his majesty and his glory and his honor so that we might be reconciled to God in his suffering through death on a Roman cross in your place and mine. So that we could be the Psalm 8 person. The disconnect is no longer there, but in Jesus, it's been restored. If Jesus is prepared to do that, then my question for us is, are you prepared to give up the glory and honor that you work so hard for and come to Jesus, through whom glory and honor are ours? Because when Jesus crowns us with glory and honor, then we become the people that are in God's image, that can love each other no matter what, that can love others, that can give God the glory that he deserves, that can rule over his works of his hands the best we can in this fallen and broken world. There's no other way to work this out. Are you prepared to give up the glory and honor that you work so hard for and accept the glory and honor that Jesus alone can give you to become that Psalm 8 person? Because God sees you. You matter. And that's what the psalm is telling us. Even when life is like the lament psalms, God hasn't left. And in fact, he proved that in his son. You see, the world looks for a reason to say, I love you. But we already have one. We're made in God's image. He made us, he's mindful of us, he cares for us. And we need to stop messing with it. Jesus' death and resurrection settled the problem of our alienation from God, our lack of ability to fulfill our purpose, as it says in Psalm 8. He restored that. We are in his image, and no image that you can come up with can add to that or can overcome that. It's free. Will you give up the glory and honor you've worked so hard for and accept the glory and honor that God crowns us with in his son, Jesus?